Okay. Good. Well, we shall call the regular and supplemental meetings to order and recess the supplemental meeting. Our first item is on page 5 of the Diligent book. It's a moment of silence for those retired members and pensioners who have passed away in July. Take a moment of silence, please. Okay, thank you, everybody. Next item on our agenda is the approval of the minutes that are on pages 6 to 11. We made only one change that went out lastly is that we, in the original set, we had the motion on the allowing Kelly to make investments in Vista Ridge 7 and Lone Star in two different places. We now just have it in the one place after the Vista Ridge 7 discussion. Are there any comments, changes, corrections anybody has to the minutes? Not hearing any. I'll move we approve them. Do we have a second?
I'll second, Bill. It's Gilbert.
Second.
Okay, thank you, Gilbert. Well, anybody opposed? No. Okay, they passed. Next on our agenda is the detailed consent agenda. Kelly, anything that you want to point out here?
No, there's nothing unusual on this agenda.
Okay. I'll move forward. Do we have a second?
Second.
Susan. Thank you, Susan. Okay, anybody opposed? Not hearing anybody, we'll approve them, unanimously approve them. Okay, next we will go to the, see if anybody, John, if anybody in the public domain there has a, wants to address the board at all.
If you'll press 5-star on your phone, and we'll unmute you so you can talk to the board. I am not seeing any.
Okay. Since there is no one, we'll just move on with the rest of our agenda. First item is Kelly on the monthly contribution report.
Good morning, everybody. On page 16 is the monthly contribution report that you are well used to seeing at this point. One thing I did want to point out, which is a little bit unusual, I think this is the first time this has happened, we actually have more police officers on this report than they had in the hiring plan. I don't recall that happening since we've been tracking this. So this is the August report, and it's based on June data. In the last payroll in June, there was 110 employees on that payroll. 110 employees in excess of what the hiring plan said. 96 of those were in fire and 14 were in police. That's a 60-person increase over the prior month, which I find actually to be a, you know, very large number. We'll see if that holds. Hopefully it will. On the next page of the report, we have the city contributions and the employee contributions. For the month of June, there was two pay periods, so we received $5.6 million in city contributions. That's 98% of the floor and 107% of the hiring plan. So that's looking very strong, continues to be strong. Since HB 3158 became effective, we've received actual contributions of $366.4 million, contributions because of this floor and extra contributions of $38.4 million. The actual contributions based on the payroll have been 91% of the floor and 99% of the hiring plan. So, again, you know, we all know we kind of started out strong, but with the city's efforts of hiring and then their pay increases, it's helped a lot in catching those numbers up. So that's a good sign. Employee contributions follow the city contributions with except for the floor. So those numbers are in line with that. Other than that, the only thing I wanted to mention related to the city contributions is the city did a very large software implementation, changing their old loss and payroll system to Workday. It was a, you know, huge project, and we were nervous, I think is kind of an understatement on how that would impact us. And, you know, we've been pleasantly surprised that we've seen, you know, some errors and some questions, but a lot less than we anticipated seeing. So we're very pleased with that. We know that they've worked hard on that. They have a lot of things they're still working on, which is normal in a project like that. So right now we currently don't have the same access in Workday that we did have in Lawson. So that's creating a little bit of a problem for our benefits counselors, but we're being patient with the city, and you know, they have their hands full with Workday and a lot of other things right now. So I think things are on track and looking good. Are there any questions about the contribution report that I can answer for you?
I'm not hearing any. You want to go to your next item, Kelly?
Sure. The next item is the board approval of the travel and education. And there's been no request from the board during this time frame, so there's nothing, no motion that's needed. We do have one item listed on here, which is the NCFERS public pension funding forum. And I think I may have said this last time, of all the NCFERS classes and conferences I've been to, this has been the best one. In my opinion, because it's really focused on the actuarial piece and not so much of, you know, a variety that you might get in their normal annual conference. I don't know what it's going to be like as a virtual event. It is half days. It looks like it's half days on August 24th and 25th, and that's a $250 cost. If anybody's interested in attending that, let Carol know, and she can help you get registered for that. Other than that, I know the new trustee that's coming out in September is doing a class, but there's no cost to that, so there's no board approval that needs to happen on that one. So nothing more on this item.
Okay. if there's nothing else, then Brenda, do you want to give us an update on the audit and then go into the financial statements?
Yes. Thank you, Bill. Good morning, everyone. As Bill said, I'm going to give you an update on the financial audit for DPFP. The largest outstanding item remains investment audited financial statements. The Lone Star audited financial statements have been received, and we are currently reviewing them. The Huff General Manager has told us to expect the Huff Alternative Fund financial statements in August and the Huff Energy Fund statements in September or October, which is about the same time frame as last year. Once we receive these remaining financial statements, then we will be able to submit information to the actuary. And once information is submitted to the actuary, it should be about 60 days to the completion of our financial statement. Currently, the staff is continuing to work on portions of the financial statements and the CAFR that can be completed as we wait for these last investment financial. I also wanted to let you know that I did notify the PRB that we would not meet the July 29th due date for our financials, and I will continue to update them each month going forward on the status of our audit financials. I also requested and received an extension from the GFOA, that's the Government Finance Officers Association, for submitting our CAFR, our Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, and I will continue to request extensions from them as needed. Are there any questions about the status of the financial audit?
One question I have, not necessarily the status, but you said you got Lone Star's financial statements. Were their valuations very different than what we've been seeing up till now, either higher or lower?
Yes, their valuations were higher. Currently, the kind of Lone Star subcommittee and the staff are reviewing those valuations along with the Conway McKenzie valuations and trying to determine a strategy for the valuation this year.
What kind of was the difference? Is it a little or a lot? I mean, what percentage? Sorry, Bill.
No, go ahead, Nick. That's good.
I don't have that information in front of me. On some of the funds, they were closer. On some, they were far apart or farther apart, certainly all higher than our current carrying value.
This is Kent. Let me just jump in. Why don't, Ryan, if you can just kind of gather that information, and we'll cover that, just summarize that, your observations of that when we get to the portfolio update in a few minutes. Because I think Ryan's got a little more perspective on that.
Okay, that's good, because I think BDO does their own evaluation too, although mainly it's the Huff one that they seem to be more focused on, but we'll get their feedback as well, I would think.
That's correct. So BDO will review in the past, because we had a separate valuation from Duff and Phelps, they would review that valuation as well as the information from HUF. So there will be a further examination from them.
Okay.
Any other?
Go ahead, Brenda.
No, I was going to ask if there were any other questions about the status of the audit and finance.
Nope, we can go on to your next item, then, the quarterly financials.
Thank you. John, if you'll go ahead and move to the next page. As Bill said, next I'm going to be reviewing our June 30th financials, and we just spoke about it, but just a reminder that the December 31 results that you see are preliminary, and you will see them noted as preliminary in the papers. I want to start with the bridge chart, and just to orient anyone who may not be familiar with this chart, we start on the left-hand side with the 1231 net position, then we adjust for investment, benefit, and operations-related transactions during the period to arrive at the 6/30/2020. So on the left-hand side, 1231, the preliminary net position was $2.1 billion. We had investment-related transactions. See them in the green shaded area. Over the first half of the year, they decreased the net position by $48 million. Then in the yellow shaded area, you'll see benefits and operation-related transactions. They decreased the net position by $4.4 million. And then on the right-hand side, 6/30/2020 net position is $1.998 billion, down $102 million as of 12/31/19. And John, if you'll turn the page. Next, I just want to briefly discuss some of the highlights from the financials. First, I'll start with total investments, top portion of the schedule. Total investments at June 30th were $1.919 billion compared to $1.996 billion as of 12/31/19, or a decrease of $77 million. The overall decline in the investment value was led primarily by fixed income and real assets investments. In fixed income, we had withdrawals from IR&M of $56 million during the period, and from Loomis of $37 million, and these were offset by purchases of Vanguard of $20 million and Pacific Asset Management of $37 million. In the real asset area, we had distributions from AEW of $10 million and Museum Tower of $6.8 million. And those distributions, along with some valuation declines, contributed to the reduction in real assets. As we move down the schedule about midway, you'll see cash and cash equivalents. They decreased $27 million from 12/31/19. There were two portfolio rebalancings during the first quarter that used $17 million cash. Additionally, the pension shortfall during the first half of the year was $51 million, and these outflows were partially offset by distributions and income from assets. As we continue down the page, we see accounts payable and accrued liabilities. They declined to $258,000. And that decline can be contributed to a decrease in the fund management accrual, which was down $437,000. Refunds payable were down $60,000. And these decreases were partially offset by increases in accounts payable, which was up $54,000. Accrued liabilities were up $84,000. And our uncompensated absence accrual is $132,000. Now I want to look at the changes in fiduciary positions. John, if you'll go to the next page. Thank you. The first section is contributions. City contributions increased $3.5 million year over year. This is primarily related to the increase of floor that went into effect at the beginning of 2020. Or increased from $5.571 million to $5.724 million per pay period, and that accounts for the majority of that increase. Member net contributions increased $2.6 million year over year, and member contributions increased $2.84 million. And that's primarily due to the increase in the number of employees. The number of employees are up 235 over 6/30/2019. And as well as an increased number of employees, there have been increased salaries as well. We had, during this period, we had pension buybacks increased 48,000. But offsetting these increases was a decline in drop contributions, and that was down $450,000 when compared to last. As we move into the investment section, the net appreciation depreciation changed from 630 when compared to 30/2019 is $144 million. And that increase is primarily driven by changes in the public and fixed income market. As we continue to move down the page to deductions, net benefits paid to members increased 5.3 million year over year. Service pensions increased by 4.3 million, and survivor benefits increased by 1.1 million, but they were partially offset by a decline in disability payments of $135,000 when compared to the same period last year. New service retirements at higher monthly benefits is the primary driver in the increase in benefits paid to members. As we move down into the expense section, with legal expense has increased $135,000 over the same period last year, due primarily to reduced fees for our ongoing plan cases, which were down $132,000 year over year. As we look at staff salaries and benefits, they have increased year over year due primarily to the filling of an open position, and staff vacation is continuing to be earned and accrued, but has not been taken at the normal rate because of COVID-19. And as we look at professional and administrative expenses, variance year over year is $112,000, and it's generally related to new expenses or the timing of expenses. COVID-19 expenses account for $19,000 of the increase. Also, the actuarial experience study was conducted this year, and that accounts for $70,000 of the increase. The remaining variance is related in part just to the timing of expenses. So I'm going to stop here for a moment and ask if there are any questions about the financials.
Yeah, quick one, Brenda. What is our policy on unused vacation? Does it just carry over, or is it use it or lose it, or what is it today, and you know, what are we thinking as we with COVID-19, how we may want to change it?
So employees are allowed to carry over vacation up to a maximum, depending on how many hours they're allowed to earn. So they can carry it over. We do have some employees who are hitting the max now because they already had some carryover vacation. They haven't taken time, and we're looking and discussing ways to address this kind of period of no one's taking vacation, but they're continuing to earn and carry over. But there is a carryover both for vacation and for sick leave.
Yeah.
One thing, Bill, that I'd like to add, this is Kelly, is that Brenda and I have talked about this, and we're thinking about, as she said, ideas on what we need to do, if anything, what changes after the first of the year. And one thing to keep in mind is the way DPFP accrues vacation is your basic, and this is, goes back, I think, to the city or something, but you actually accrue your full year of vacation in the first 10 months of the year. So the last 2 months, October, November, or November, December, nobody accrues any more vacation. It's kind of front-end loaded for the first 10 months of the year. So that's why we're thinking, well, you know, we would wait until the first of the year to see if we need to make any changes there, because nothing will increase in November and December. So we have a couple more months where people could increase their accruals, if that makes sense.
Yep.
Yeah, Can I ask a question?
Hey, Kelly. Go ahead.
Can I ask a question? So we get to affect accruals in that way. Like, we get to have some influence on what to do with vacation and sick time.
So the board has adopted personnel rules, and in those in the personnel policy, it talks about the vacation accruals and how much, depending on the years of service that employees accrue, and the maximum amount.
So we're talking about staff.
Accrue. Pardon me?
We're talking about staff?
Yes. but the board has adopted the policy that sets out those rules. And one of the changes, operational changes that we've made with this COVID pandemic is we've allowed people that were at the maximum to not lose their vacation during this time. And that's the piece that we need to rethink if we still want to do that or have people take time. Our fear was if everybody was accruing all this vacation and not taking any time, once we got back to normal, that was the thinking at the time, we might at some point get back to normal, everybody, we'd go back in the office and then everybody would be on vacation for the first month at the same time everybody was out. So that was kind of the thinking there. But yes, the board approves the policy for the amount of vacation and sick leave and all of those things that the staff member receives.
Hey,
okay,
Kelly,
so
it's Armando.
The only other thing, too, is because I'm just thinking about how, like, the fire department was handled, and I'm not sure how that happened in the COVID world, because, like, in the firefighter world, when one guy got infected and then the rest had to take off, they were kind of, like, said, okay, no, this will be, like, a paid leave, and it wasn't, and they had to kill, like, their sick time or their vacation time in that process, which was kind of like an ad hoc situation. I'm just kind of curious, you know, if we kind of like cap it off, I mean, are they, like, do we allow them to use this time just in case they get, I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, in the world of COVID.
Yeah,
quickly,
I know what you're saying.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so back in the beginning, back in March and April, Josh and I worked on some policies and procedures related to COVID. If an employee is diagnosed with COVID, if they have a family member diagnosed with COVID, if their kids can't go to school because of COVID, those types of things, and what they would, what leave they would be able to use and not. And Josh can jump in if I'm saying anything incorrect because I haven't read this in a little while. But basically, we follow the federal guidelines of allowing, if somebody, let's say, you have COVID, or basically your kids couldn't go to school at the time because the school was closed down because of COVID.
Correct.
Or the daycare was.
Correct.
You would
Correct.
Have up to two weeks of leave that you could take that was basically COVID leave. It wouldn't be used against your accrual banks, but after that two-week period, you would use your leave if you wanted to have that time paid. We didn't have anybody in that situation.
Reason why I'm saying this is that you don't want to put it as a – you don't want to penalize people. Like, I just think that if you allow some more latitude when it comes to vacation so that pay would stay intact, that people would be more prone to be honest about their exposures without exposing everybody else, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Because – yeah. So if you're very liberal about the time, then if they have been exposed, they're going to be more prone to use that time than infect others. That's all I'm saying. And I think that there's a way that you can incentivize employees to not infect
everybody. I agree with that. And let me just add this, and then Josh can jump in with whatever I said that he needs to fix. That, you know, unlike the fire department where they did have to go to work all the time and they were interacting with the public and each other, you know, some of our employees I haven't seen since March. You know, I go in the office and there are different employees in, you know, depending on the time. So we're not all together, which is helps us, I think, in an environment versus a fire department. Josh, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think yes and no. I think your description was accurate. I would remind that in March, the board passed a motion giving Kelly the authority to amend or suspend the provisions of the personnel policy, you know, while the pandemic was ongoing, which obviously it's continuing to be. So you have delegated some authority to her to deal with the situation, which I think is what she's doing not only with what she's talking about in terms of the policy we've drafted with respect to COVID and leave, but also sort of dealing with the vacation situation to make sure that people are not unduly, you know, prejudiced and that we've had adequate staffing and things like that. And, of course, the board can step in, and I think this is a perfectly good discussion, not only under this agenda item, but under the office COVID agenda item as well. But I just wanted to remind the board that you had actually delegated to Kelly authority to deal with the personnel policy with respect to COVID.
Okay. I just, very good. I mean, it's just such a fluid situation that you just kind of want to, you don't know what you don't know with the second wave, let's say, per se.
Was there somebody else who wanted to say something? I said earlier.
Yeah, Bill, it's Armando. Hey, I know that in the fire department we have a policy that at the end of the year, at the end of the calendar year, end of November, you can, it's called the Vacation Buyback Program. Our members that are assigned to fire stations can actually sell back vacation time for example, 2021 at today's rate. Some people like to have the cash in their pocket right before Christmas time instead of booking the vacation for the next year. But you can only, there's very strict guidelines around it. And maybe this is a conversation that we need to have offline. But I was wondering if there was any type of policies in place similar to that for your staff members. And I know we're living in really weird times right now, and we're having to think about a lot of different things because you're right. Some people are accruing, but they hit the max, but they can't take off because of whatever. So I'm just trying to maybe brainstorm, help you guys figure out some things and throw some ideas out there. But Tina's also right. I mean, it's good to have that time in your back pocket for COVID leave if you were to need it. So just kind of spitballing and just throwing that out there and asking if you guys had any policy in that regard.
Armando, that's actually something I hadn't thought about, but no, we don't have any policy in place that a current employee can get paid for any of their leave. And, I can see there's definite pros and cons to that.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, I mean, I'm encouraging people to take time because I know, just speaking for myself, you know, I'm hesitant to do that because I can't travel or whatever. But when I do take a day, it's just a great mental health day. So
yep.
I'd really like people to, you know, try to find a way to use the time versus just continue to store up the time and then try to take a whole chunk later. I think for mental health reasons, it's good for everybody. But, I mean, all suggestions are helpful.
Well, I think, Kelly, I mean, you made it point that you were looking at where we stood at the end of October. I think to bring back to the board what you want to make changes to or how flexible we want to be, because I think we do want to be flexible, and I do understand people don't want to take a lot of vacation now if they can't go anywhere. So I think if you can just come back with your recommendations and maybe the November meeting or thereabouts, that would probably be helpful. Discussion and put that on the agenda.
Okay, sounds good.
Hey, this is Joe. What was the open position that was filled?
That was the investment analyst, the position that Mike Yang
okay.
is filling.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions on the financials before we go to the budget review? Hearing none, Brenda, do you want to move us to the budget?
Yes. We have one more chart that I want to look at that's part of the financials. It's the net benefit shortfall chart. And again, just for anyone who might not be familiar with this chart graphically represents the shortfall between benefit contribution and benefit payment. And for the last three quarters, the benefit payments, which are in the orange, are holding steady around 79 $80 million per quarter, and benefit contributions, which are in the blue, are holding steady around $54 to $55 million. And then the yellow bar is the average monthly shortfall. For the average monthly shortfall in the second quarter was $8.375 million. But I do want to note that this chart includes only benefit and contribution transactions. It does not include any cash outflow related to system expenses. So it's not a true cash inflow outflow. It's just related to benefit contributions versus benefit payments to see where we're going. You can see as you go back to the first quarter of 2017, the average monthly shortfall at that point was $14 million, and the progress has now been made to cut that almost in half to $8.3 million. So are there any questions about the net benefit shortfall chart? If not, then let's move on to talk about the budget. And so go one more page, John. Thank you. Can you make that just a little bigger? So we're going to talk about the 2020 mid-year budget review. That's what this is. During this review, we will look at the actual versus budget results for administrative, professional, and investment expenses for the first 6 months of 2020. This schedule shows account names with their 2020 actual, 2020 budget, 2019 actual, and then along with the variance. And as we go through the presentation, we will examine some of the largest variances in more detail. And I just kind of want to start with what are some of the general reasons that there could be some variances. First is our budget is created on an annual basis and then straight lined over the year. And some expenses are typically heavier in the earlier part of the year, things such as payroll taxes. So that creates a negative variance. But then by the time you get to the end of the year, that variance will shrink. Some are heavier in the latter part. Other reasons could be some expenses come in kind of a lumpier fashion, something, you know, with large invoices that cover a project or a period, something like IT projects or audit fees. You get kind of one big invoice, and those will typically kind of smooth themselves out over the year. And, of course, this year we've had COVID-19, and it is creating some variance either with unbudgeted expenses or a delay in expense. As we look at this schedule, it is sorted by the highest over budget variance to the highest under budget variance. And John, if you'll move down the schedule a little bit, about three-fourths of the way down the page, you'll see a line titled gross total. Little bit more. There we go. And in the next to last column, you'll see that on an overall basis, kind of that blue shaded column, that the administrative and professional expenses for the first 6 months are $273,000 under budget. And at the bottom of the page, if you scroll just a little bit more, John, you'll see that investment expenses are about $1 million under budget. So for the administrative and professional expenses, our highest over budget item is audit fees, and our highest under budget item is legal. John, would you move to the next page?
Just before you get there, Brenda, can you comment on actual salaries and benefits are about $40,000 worse than budget? Just the
yes. So this is. That we have the salary and budget that is about $40,000 higher. It is what we were talking previously about the vacation accrual, and it's the addition of the person we budgeted, but It's the timing of the vacation. So we're continuing to accrue and expense the vacation that people are earning. And normally that would be offset by people taking vacations, but they're not taking vacations. So that is pushing the salary number higher because people are earning time, and what would be reduced would be taking time, and they're not doing that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. John, would you go ahead and go to the next page? Thank you. And maybe make that a little bit bigger. Thank you. So what we're going to do is look at budget changes where the variance is either it has to be both $10,000 and a 5% variance. So we have two items that meet this criteria that are over budget. So the first is audit fees, $45,000 over budget. And this is truly related to timing. Again, budget is straight lined over the year. We've done the biggest part of the work on the budget and expense that in the first part. We expect to be within budget with this item by the end of the year. The next item is COVID-19 expenses. Again, this was not a budgeted item. It was a new account that we created track COVID-19 expenses, things such as temperature scanners, acrylic guards, sanitizer, et cetera. We wanted to be able to track and see how much are we spending on these particular types of expenses. Now let's move into reductions or items that are under budget. So the first item is legal fees. It's $136,000 under budget, and it's related to the timing of expenses along with fewer cases than we forecast. As we look at information technology projects, we're about $40,000 under budget. Project start dates were delayed due to COVID, and at least one project may be delayed until 2021. As we look at repairs and maintenance, which are $37,000 under budget, planned maintenance is currently being delayed or deferred during COVID. Moving down to network security monitoring, it's about $29,000 under budget. Same thing, this is a project for 24/7/365 monitoring. The project start date was delayed due to COVID, and it may result in some of the budgeted expenses being pushed into 2021. As we look at staff travel, $20,000 under budget, and again, no one's traveling. It's significantly reduced because of COVID. We look at liability insurance, about $20,000 under budget. The actual premium increases that we received during our renewals were less than we budgeted, so we ended up having a favorable variance. We expected a larger increase than the actual renewal was, so that's creating that favorable variance. Looking at conference training registration and materials, again, staff is not attending in person any conferences, that significantly reduced that. And then travel on the board, the board has had no travel during the first month. And if we scroll down just a little bit, we'll look at investment expenses. You had fund management fees that are $112,000 budget. Under budget, and what we're seeing here on this schedule are direct fees only, does not include any direct fees that are charged straight to the fund. And this is due to the timing of some expenses, some of the fund management fees are performance fees, and they're due and paid at the end of the year. As we look at investment portfolio operating expenses under budget by $397,000, and related to the timing of audits, appraisals, some expenses for investment contracts review, or advisors and legal fees have been less than forecast so far. With investment due diligence, there was some planned travel and the purchase of an investment software, and that has not yet occurred. And finally, when we look at investment consulting and reporting related to the timing of expenses, and we do expect this to be within budget by the end of the year. Are there any questions related to the budget review?
No, not hearing any. Okay, we'll move on to the report of the audit committee. Committee is made up of Armando, Tina, Nick, Joe, and myself. After the last board meeting, we held a virtual audit committee meeting with BD&O. The main item we talked about was that we have a policy that we're supposed to send out an RFP for auditors every 5 years. Last year, we decided not to do that in 2019 because of continuity and all of those other issues we were dealing with. We did decide this would be a year to go ahead and do that. So Brenda has prepared a schedule where she's going to prepare the RFP in October, and send it out in November. Then in January, we'll be interviewing firms and bring to the board a recommendation on whether or not we should be switching auditors or not in February. So that's been laid out, so we're going to go forward with that. One of the things we looked at, and I think the audit committee saw that, I noticed that when the PCAOB issued their most recent findings on deficient audits, BD&O was one of the higher ones on there. So we scheduled a call with them to go over that to find out what the problem was. It was probably we spent more time on it than we needed to, but they had a senior partner who's in charge of compliance who addressed the issue in extraordinary detail. But basically their conclusion was they are a much smaller firm with a lot smaller clients, medium and small-sized clients who tend to be less sophisticated and have more control deficiencies, and they think that's why they're being cited versus the bigger firms who deal with the mega companies that have better controls, internal audit departments, et cetera. I think the one thing that did come out is that our partner, Jill, was, you know, considered to be a real superstar within the BDO lineup, and I think my experience with her is she's been very, very good. So that was the call with them. So I don't know, does anybody else on the audit committee want to add anything?
No, that's pretty accurate. I think also there was just talking about the nature of why they got, why they were done, you know, ding, dong, whatever, however you say, I think it's dinged. and they said that to remedy it was rather small. Like it was a big red flag for something that was really small to resolve. That's the only thing I would add, really.
Okay, thanks, Tina. Anybody else? Any questions from the rest of the board? Okay, hearing none, we will go to Kent for a couple of items here on the portfolio, update and lending and private equity, et cetera. So, Kent, it's all yours.
Yep. Thanks, Bill. Bill, am I coming through okay on the phone here?
Yes.
Okay, good. So first off, I'll address the question that came up earlier on the Lone Star valuation, and I'll just talk to this kind of in broad brushstrokes. And first, noting that you know the audit was at year end 2019, and a lot has changed since then. But it was similar to what we've seen in previous years, where the valuation, the financial statement valuations continued to decline. And we've, you know, there's, we have done some independent work on the valuation here and have come up with, you know, somewhat lower values. And so I would say that there was nothing in the financial statements that changed our views. If anything, I think maybe this year, well, I better not, I don't want to say yet, but, you know, we're, as Brenda mentioned, we're looking about kind of how we ought to incorporate or how we ought to come to our 2019 valuations. So, Ryan, I'll just, I'm kind of talking off of information that you had provided to me and the team. Anything else you'd like to kind of add to that?
No, I mean, we have a ton of detail, you know, company by company where different groups' values lie at. So we can get pretty granular on how we come up with our value. Obviously, there's some bigger disparities on the energy heavier fund as opposed to CRA. So.
Thanks, Ryan. I think that that's good for that for now. John, you started off normally where I right where I want to go, but first I want to just take a look at a couple of Brenda's charts. If you could go to slide 25, please. And so just want to point out a couple numbers here, just kind of put in the back of your head. And the first is the investment-related decline in the first half of the year of, let's just call that $48 million. And then the benefits and operations out, about $54 million. It's about $9 million a month. And that's what, you know, that's that kind of net shortfall, you know, plus the fund expenses. And then if you can go forward two slides, slide 27, John. And so here, I just wanted to call out kind of net investment income. You'll see that about a third of the way down, you know, negative $48 million, just the number I just kind of called out. And then we're going to talk about securities lending here in a few minutes. And so you can see there a few lines down. That was $22,583 for the first half of the year as versus about $70,000 for the first half of last year. So, you know, down somewhat. And you can see kind of relative also those are pretty small numbers relative to some of the say, investment income. Okay, with that, John, if you can go back where you were on the presentation. Let me get myself there as well. Okay, so here on slide 35, just want to point out a couple of items, and I'm going to go to the adjusted asset allocation on the next page. So kind of near the bottom, you'll see the row marked total, and at the end of July, we were at $2,000,012, so $2 billion. Safety reserve right below that at $266 million and private market assets on the books at $832. If you go to the next slide, and this is where we adjust those values for our estimates of kind of the private market, the impact on private market valuations, which are not yet shown in the books. And this is staff rough estimates, but we think it's informative and important kind of as we think about where the portfolio is going, because we don't think, we know that the certain parts of the portfolio have not brought in kind of the impact on valuation that has kind of happened in the first half of 2020. And Ryan's talked about this in previous meetings, so I won't go into a lot more detail there. But if you look back kind of at those same numbers or so same sections I was pointing out, you'll see that kind of the total drops down to about $1.8 billion, $172, and the private market assets dropped from 832 to 602. And so we're considering this as we look at kind of our asset allocation, because this is where we think we're going to go. The safety reserve at 266, we call it the safety reserve, is designed to provide 2.5 years of net outflow. And so you know, that would be about $270 million at $9 million a month. And so we're pretty close to where we need to be there. But we see nothing on the horizon with a great deal of certainty in terms of private market asset liquidations that is going to fund that negative $9 million a month. So as we look forward the next few months for funding that, what we're going to do is we're going to, you'll see that some of the fixed income allocations, bank loans and high yield bonds are a little overweight relative to this, so we're going to pull that back. And then in future months, recall we had made a contribution to global equity in March, and we may pull some of that back. And we'll continue to work with, we've been working with Makita Investment Advisory Committee, chair has been very helpful on this as well, you know, evaluating where to go, and so we'll keep you posted on that. But essentially what we're using our asset allocation implementation plan, which is kind of how we would allocate new private market liquidations, kind of in reverse, well, when they're not coming, of where we're going to go for the money. And the overall idea here is to keep fixed income near target and flex on the equity. So let me get my bearings here. I think I've covered most of what I wanted to cover there. Yes. Okay, moving forward to the next page, slide 37. And here on performance, so always try to make this qualification. This is just kind of what's been happening lately. It's not a manager evaluation, which kind of involves longer periods of time as well as many other aspects other than what the performance has been. You'll see the top line there, and that's we have quarter to date. So that's just July, and then we have year to date in kind of the second columns, and then we have manager, index, and excess. This is what each of those categories have. So with global equity up for the quarter, about 5% excess return, you know, trailing a little bit in global equity. Year to date, you know, down about 2.5%.
I'm sorry. What slide are you on? I'm sorry. What slide are you on?
37.
And it's
a gray bar at the top of slide 37 titled Global Equity. That row is labeled Global Equity. And so that was typically when you see a similar number when they shouldn't be the same, like we do for the excess for July and year to date, that indicates more likely a problem than not, that those numbers are actually different. It should go out a few decimals. It's just a coincidence. And in terms of performance, kind of the same old themes here where we have our managers that have been outperforming year-to-date, Invesco and Walter Scott have been doing a good job and have also had some growth tailwinds, and our managers that have been underperforming have value headwinds. And for Boston Partners, it's been, you know, they are more have more of a style value style bias, and so we show them versus the value index there. And that the growth value, I guess the diversion in the past couple of years has just been huge. And so you can just see for Boston Partners, just the index, value index versus the core, it's you know, more than 14%. So that doesn't even take into account the growth side of it. So it's a huge issue that's going on. Moving down to fixed income, up for the quarter, up for the year. And just looking kind of at excess year-to-date, strong performance from income research, strong performance from Lumis High Yield. And Lumis is, as I kind of called out before, they outperformed in the first quarter, in the second quarter, and in July. So they're one of the most consistent outperformers that we've had. And then Pacific Asset Management also doing a good job year-to-date. So generally real satisfied there. Brandywine, which was down 10% in the first quarter, is digging themselves out of a hole. And so their underperformance has kind of moderated significantly. We'll head on to 38, please. And this is a slide that had changed earlier this morning. I apologize for that. So recall that on Brenda's slides, we were down $48 million for the first half of the year. And typically what I've done is said, you know, public markets is driving most of that. But here you see in the top row, kind of under 1H20, first half of 20, total public markets impact is $33 million negative. And so we've got another, $15 million in there. And that's coming from some of the private markets. We have infrastructures down a bit, natural resources down a little bit, in private equity, private debt, kind of not related to the bigger ones yet, and offset by some year-end positive impact from the real estate. But public markets down about 33 for the first half, still positive in July, and so we're actually, public markets are positive year to date. And I think the rest of it gets tedious pretty quickly, so I kind of won't cover a lot more at this point on that one. But I will kind of stop and ask if there's any questions about the performance impact overall. Okay. And the next slide, just on investment initiatives. So always have our liquidation of private markets. So it is our one of the key things we're always working on. We continue to do a lot of work here, although I said we don't expect anything in the near term. You know, we do have some things that continue to unfold and are moving forward for monetization next year. So we continue to put a lot of work in that area. We did complete the investment grade bond transition from Vanguard to Longfellow. We'll kind of cover that briefly in the next section. But all is going well, and it's all completely over at Longfellow now. So as you know, we have a couple of private equity funds that have been struggling, and we continue kind of a lot of time engaging with those issues. We have, as you approved last month, two new members, external members to the Investment Advisory Committee, and so we did hold a session with them to try to bring them up, orient them to the investment portfolio, get them up to speed so they can hit the ground running when we next meet, currently planned in September. I spent a little bit of time this month working on kind of reviewing securities lending. We're going to talk about that in a second, and also some time kind of evaluating what to do about funding the cash flow, and we talked about that. So, and then some of the things that are kind of on deck to hit next. Any questions about these? Okay. Next slide, just briefly. This is just kind of our scorecard of, we're walking through the portfolio kind of one asset class or section at a time. And so that's the check marks are where we've been. And Greg Earlbeck is going to give us a brief review of private equity and debt here coming up. And, you know, with all these things, we try to just highlight things. If there's an area where you want us to come back later and go into detail, or you want more report or anything, just let us know. But Greg will be hitting that shortly. Okay, next briefly on slide 41, and I'm not going to talk about the transition kind of analysis and reporting for Longfellow. Main point I want to make here is that there's the potential to kind of lose ground in a transition if you're not if you don't maintain your market exposure, if securities kind of go the wrong way while you're transitioning. So I always want to kind of have a plan for how we're going to do this. And, you know, how did it go? And so in this case, and I'll just kind of cut the chase and a couple pages down, we got the money over there. In this case, we did it in three tranches because there was going to be Vanguard told us it would be a three-day settlement. It was actually a one-day settlement, and everything worked very well over there. And so in the interim, we funded on day zero from cash, and then, you know, cash was replenished the next day, so we were able to maintain market exposure. And Longfellow got duration exposure kind of right away, and then have been easing into the corporate exposure, and they'll continue that over the next few days. You know, I think by mid-August we're probably pretty close now. And then we just tried to look at what the Vanguard account would have done if we hadn't taken any money out, and kind of where we ended up. And, you know, we think that we're pretty much, you know, flat, so that's a good thing. Any questions about that? Okay. So next, moving on to securities lending, and actually I'm going to move up a couple of slides here. So John, if you could go to slide 47. Thank you. So when I first got here in mid-2018, shortly after that, we were evaluating the securities lending in cash reinvestment guidelines. We spent some time on that, and, you know, we were spending time on that because we thought that we were going to be getting back to historical levels of securities lending income, which you can see kind of 2012, was it $718,000. Even in 2015, it was $544,000. It went down in 2016 and then into 17 because the plan was pulling a lot of money and selling a lot of securities in global equities to fund cash flow, and so it was very difficult for the custodian to administer a securities lending program where we're all selling stuff. So that was a key driver, but we expected as things stabilized in 2018 that that would jump right back up to 2000, you know, prior levels, you know, close to a half million dollars a year. But what you can see in 18 and 19 is it really has kind of been sitting around that $100,000 level. And if you recall from the number I pointed out earlier, it's at $22,000 for the first half of the year, which would be a $45,000 a year pace. And the numbers kind of below just show that, you know, if you look at that total lending base, and this was just me kind of eyeballing it, looking at our financial statements and fixed income and equity securities and kind of what we should have had approximately, you know, to lend, and you can see how it kind of went down and then came back up. And this is just end of year numbers, so it doesn't actually show the lower points. And so, you know, the issue here is that there's, like everything, it takes a little bit of time to administer a program like this, and there's a little bit of risk to it. Now, J.P. Morgan, our custodian, administers the program as an agent, so they're not a fiduciary investment manager. And the risk, and it's modest, but the risk is that there is cash collateral is reinvested, and we have guidelines for that that are relatively safe. But it does require some monitoring, probably more than we've been doing because we haven't been looking at it very closely. And, you know, just as an example, you know, I was just, this was last year, and I was just picking a day to kind of look at what our, you know, what our cash collateral was invested in. And, you know, at that particular time, Deutsche Bank had been in the news. There were some concerns over there, and, you know, we had a Deutsche Bank repo in there. And there's nothing wrong with that. It met the guidelines, but it kind of, you know, that was probably, you know, providing a little more income for a reason. And, you know, you really have to go back to 2008 to really kind of, you know, see how these things can get sideways. And, you know, that while J.P. Morgan, you know, guarantees to make up any kind of loss on borrowed securities that are not returned, kind of the investment, any investment losses on cash collateral, we would suck that all up. And so they share in the profits. But you know, we take the loss. So that's a concern there. And for something that's relatively, you know, small, you know, I think that probably the attention and the modest risk that goes with that, you know, I think it's not worth it. And we're recommending, you know, to suspend the program. John, if you could go back, I think it's slide 45, which is the summary on this. Nope, up one. Thank you, 46. And so we've had, you know, conversations with J.P. Morgan about, you know, what's going on in the lending market, and is, you know, is there anything we can do? Are they, you know, and we've asked a number of questions from a number of different angles, and basically this comes down to supply and demand. I mean, there's a lot of people out there wanting to lend securities. There's less, you know, I think overall less borrowing. This is just anecdotal. I don't have data to show that other than, you know, we're continuing to lend the same amount, but there's not getting paid as much for it. And so there's really nothing we can do to increase our earnings here. And so, you know, we're recommending that we just suspend the program. We have checked with J.P. Morgan because a lot of times the securities lending income is part of the economics of a custodian relationship, but there will be no impact on our fee. I have more information in here, you know, that if we want to, we can go into it either here or offline. But I think that's really where I'll hold my comments to right now. And, you know, we are asking to recommending that we suspend the securities lending program.
The only thing I would add is that I talked to Kelly about this yesterday. She indicated there is also a fair amount of behind-the-scenes administration accounting that staff has to go through on this program, lots of journal entries, et cetera. So combination of the reasons Kent gave as well as the extra administrative headache for very little dollars being generated, nor the prospect of more being generated. You know, I would concur, and I would move that we approve the suspension of the securities lending program. So,
let me I just want to chime in because I've in the past been, you know, very adamant to keep it in place. I actually will agree. I will second that. I will support that because I've grown to understand that this is not the basic securities lending that I've been accustomed to with a hedge fund, which is essentially you have it in your books and you lend it and you make money and there's no expenses associated with it. However, the securities lending as it pertains to a pension fund is very different, as JP Morgan is acting more like an agent. And there are expenses around it. And so that I've grown to understand better, that it's not really necessarily an issue of risk, because I think the risks are properly priced. I do think that it's just an administrative cost that right now that we could do without. So I will support that. I'll second that.
Thank you, Tina. Any further discussion from anybody or questions? Okay, we've got a motion and a second. Does anybody dissent from that approving this? Okay, it passes then. Okay, we'll move on. Private equity and debt portfolio review. Is Ryan going to do this, or Ken, are you going to lead into it, or how are you going to do that?
It'd be Greg Earlbeck, our long-serving investment manager here. So, Greg, over to you, please.
I'm sorry.
No worries. Thank you. So the idea today is to provide kind of a brief high-level overview of the private equity and the private debt portfolio that really kind of talks about what we have in the portfolio and gives the who and the what. There are additional details in the appendix, which starts on page 62 of Diligent. So with that, John, if you'll go to the next page, to 56. So we start with a performance chart so that you can get an idea of what the lineup is, look at the vintage years, and kind of see what the performance has been. A couple of important things about this chart. The first is the data is of 12/31/2019, and it is preliminary at this point. We don't have the final audit values for some of these. And Makita should be getting us our Q1 report in short order, but at this point, this is the most recent data we have. So as we look at the chart, you can see that on the first column, in the vintage column, the majority of what we have left are really older vintage year, with the exception of Industry Ventures and Riverstone. So what we're seeing is this is the portfolio that's remaining. DPFP did a secondary sale of private equity in 2016 and 2017 of approximately $250 million. And so this is really kind of the remaining assets. The other thing you'll notice, and we have highlighted, is the current value column. The idea here is to kind of look at what our exposure concentration is. Obviously, with Lone Star Investment Advisors, almost $84 million, and then across the HUF funds, almost $202 million. And as you look at other private equity and private debt, there are much smaller values and much smaller exposures there. Something to note also on that HUF energy is that, you know, this is a valuation that doubled last year, and at this point it hasn't been updated for current market conditions and kind of the effects of COVID. So that's just the most recent valuation that we have for it. As you kind of look across the performance, the other thing that kind of stands out is the newer vintage years, which is Industry Ventures, and then on the debt side, Riverstone Credit Partners, those assets are actually performing, doing okay. John, if you'll go to the next page, please. So I wanted to give an idea of what the unfunded commitments are. Not a lot of data here to look at, but the key point is really just that we just have over $4.5 million of unfunded commitments, so we don't have big capital calls and expected in the near future. John, if you'll go to the next page. So we're kind of starting with the big exposures here and looking at Lone Star Investment Advisors. A lot of you already know, but this is a series of funds that's managed by Lone Star Investment Advisors. It's the Lone Star Growth Capital, Lone Star CRA, Lone Star Opportunities Fund 5, and North Texas Opportunity Fund. This was a diversified kind of traditional private equity fund that actually focused on Texas-based firms and lower middle market companies. Despite having a more diversified portfolio at the outset, the remaining investments now across the Lone Star Investment Advisors is pretty heavily concentrated in oil field service and oil and gas service companies. North Texas Opportunity Fund is a little bit unique in that there is one remaining asset there. It's Irving Holdings, which a lot of people know as Yellow Cab. This company now has really been transitioned or working to transition from providing the traditional cab services, which ran into quite a bit of competition, to providing medical transportation services. And they've recently won a couple of contracts for medical transportation that's really kind of helped to stabilize the revenues and the earnings. And they had expected that that'll make it a much more attractive candidate for a sale. However, they did have a little bit of business effect from COVID-19, so it's we'll see what that looks like as we go. Does anybody have any questions at this point? Okay. So the Huff Funds is the other big exposure there. Huff Energy, which we saw was the $202 million, is primarily in oil and gas exploration. This fund invested in about 22,000 acres, primarily in the Eagle Ford Shale, and there's operating as well as non-operating assets out there. There was a sale process working to actually sell the assets, but with the effects of COVID and what's happened with the severe market disruption in oil and gas, that sale process was interrupted and is really currently put on hold. The Huff Alternative Fund was also previously a very diversified fund with several assets, but right now the primary remaining asset is a real estate parcel that's on the Las Vegas Strip. The fund has actually a minority interest in it. There have been efforts underway to really market and monetize this and wrap that fund up. John, if you'll go to page 59, please. So as we look at the others, we have Hudson Clean Energy. This was a clean tech fund. It has now three assets that remain, and that's going to be in wind power, solar power, and wireless charging. The fund in 2019 was restructured to have a co-GP structure with Imperial Capital Management. They've been working hard to monetize the assets, but the companies really are in different phases. One's in a financial restructuring, one is raising capital, and another is essentially in wind down. So it's unclear on when we could expect monetization from those. The next is Industry Ventures. IVPH stands for Industry Ventures Partnership Holdings. This is the only venture capital exposure that we have in our portfolio, and they approach it a little bit differently with having a focus on taking secondary positions. They will basically invest in other venture capital funds, and so a lot of it they'll buy on the secondary market. Some of them they'll make primary commitments, and then they do some direct co-investment as well. But the result is a venture capital fund that has really diversified exposure. Right now, there's over 1,000 active companies that they have exposure to through their commitments. This being one of the newer vintage funds, and the fund term being 10 years, we'll expect to see some monetization since the commitment period is over, but it's just important to note that the fund term extends out to 2026. Yellowstone Industry Ventures is the next. This one, we carry at zero on our books. There is one holding, which is a ultraviolet lighting technology company. As of late, the fund has actually decided to wind down and distribute shares in kind. Any questions so far? Thank you. John, if you'll go to page 60, please. Highland Crusader has a really a nominal market value remaining. It was primarily a senior secured debt and equity fund. It's in liquidation. It's being managed by Alvarez and Marsal because Highland was removed as investment manager back in 2016. And the only remaining investment there is in a healthcare company. And then the other private debt investment is Riverstone Credit Partners. This one's focused on investments in distressed energy companies. The remaining investments really kind of split between exploration, production, midstream, and oil field service. It's kind of important to note because of their positioning with the disruption that we've seen in the oil market, they have had some pressure on the NAV in Q1. It was down approximately 15%. But because of the companies that they're invested in, the positioning, we don't expect to see a larger impact as we go forward. Also important, Riverstone, the fund is actually in wind down, and we do expect to see about half of it coming in 2021. And about half of it coming in 2022. And that really covers the portfolio. Does anybody have questions?
Thanks, Greg. There's a lot that goes into all of this, so we always struggle to try to kind of find the right level of detail. Bill, before I turn it and we leave investments, I think Leo is on the phone. I just wanted to kind of acknowledge him and just and I don't know if John, if you can just kind of unmute him, or Leo, if you can press 5-star just to see if he has any comments. Okay, thanks. Makita has been helpful kind of on all these things we've been talking about today, reviewed the securities lending. We've been talking with them about the funding of cash flow. And so, anyway, Leo, you there?
Yeah, Kent, and good morning, everyone. Hope everybody's doing well. I don't think I have any remarks to make on the private equity, private debt review that we just went over. I've participated since basically, Kent, you began a while ago going over the contribution of the public markets, and, glad to see a rebound. But I don't have any prepared remarks at this moment, but I'm happy to take any questions that come now or later while the meeting takes place.
Thanks, Leo. I just mainly wanted to let people know you guys are, involved in the process day to day, and you're out there, staying in tune today as well. With that, Bill, I think we're done. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Kent, Greg. Appreciate it. According to the agenda, we were going to go into closed session now. Two items, but I think we can cover the last two or three items before going into closed session. So I think we'll do that, then see if anybody from the public wants to address us and then go to closed session so that there is no need for them to hang around for that extra 30 or 40 minutes if not necessary. So, Kelly, do you want to take Executive Director's report?
I will. Thank you. So this is very short. The NCFERS and TechFERS publications are available for you either as part of this or with TechFERS via the link. As far as open records requests go, we received 3 since the last board meeting. One of them we actually sent a cost letter for, and they sent us a check. So that one and the other 2 have all been completed and closed, and the information has been provided. So that's all I have on the executive director's report.
Do you want to cover the, we've covered a lot of the COVID-19 item 13. Anything you want to add to that?
The one thing I wanted to talk about, and in the past month I've had this item as part of the executive director's report, but you're not really supposed to have a conversation when an item is under that, so I actually pulled this out as a separate item. As far as the office goes, we are still monitoring the county information as our guide on what to do for the office. They are still sitting at a risk level of red, which means stay home. So that's what we're doing. So since the last month, really nothing has changed. We have one person in the office every day answering the phones. We have security. We're doing mail. And then people are going into the office as need be. So that's all we have going on with the office. And I don't anticipate really any changes there over the next 4 weeks unless the board wants me to do something different. But what I did want to talk about is the September board meeting. So, things evolve quickly in the COVID world, and we never know which way they're going to go. But in September, we're going to have at least one new trustee because, as you know, Joe is leaving the board and Ken Haven will be joining the board. And the terms of some of the other trustees or the mayoral trustees are also up, which I think that we'll talk about under the other item. But I didn't know if the board wanted to do that meeting as we've done these meetings or if the board would want to do a meeting using video cameras but still virtually or being in the office. So I thought I'd put this as a separate item so you can talk about that.
This is Nick. I would like to. I think it'd be great to do it in the office. That one overflow room, I think, could create significant distance, and I think it'd be good for everyone to physically be in the same room.
I concur. It's Tina.
Does anybody have a problem with that? Or that would not be able to attend if we did it that way? But probably could still do a combination meeting if people felt uncomfortable.
Well, this is Gilbert. As the one who flies in, I'm anxious to get back in person. So, if things are at where they are kind of now, I don't have a problem flying up and back the same day.
Hey, Bill, for what it's worth, at Makita, we still have a restriction on travel. Don't know when that will be lifted. If there is a pressing request for us to travel, we'll address that on a case-by-case basis. But so far, the status quo for Makita is no travel.
Okay, that's
well. I mean, looking at firm stuff, our firm is everybody works from home, almost everybody, till October 1st. For us, the difficulty are schools. But, I mean, I don't mind coming in, so... just let me know.
Okay. Anybody think they would have a real problem coming into the office other than Leo? Okay. That sounds reasonable. Then the last item is item 12. As Kelly mentioned, Joe is going off the board after serving for 7 years. He's put a lot of time and effort into it. And he's been a good communicator to the active members out there. And, Joe, thank you very much for your service. I believe you've been on the board for almost 7 years. I don't know if that's correct. But on behalf of the board, I just want to thank you very much for your service and appreciate it and wish you the best of luck in your future endeavors, whatever they may be.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And then as far as the mayoral appointees, as Kelly indicated, Nick, Susan, and myself, our terms all expire at the end of August. There's really been no word of what's going to happen. Nick has indicated that he would like to continue to stay on the board, and based on conversations I and Kelly had with Tristan Hallman, who's the mayor's policy guy, the indication was they would expect to reappoint him, but we have no word on that. So, I just don't know if that's I expect that to happen, but I don't know that that's going to happen. As far as Susan and I, we did not ask to be reappointed to the board. Again, we have not heard anything from the mayor as to replacements. I think it's a possibility, Susan, this may be news to you, that we may do what they may, he may ask us to do what he did last year and have some holdover appointments for a relatively short period of time. But he may, and again, he may appoint somebody between now and the end of the month that makes that mute. So I just don't know. We don't get a lot of direct, timely feedback from the city on these things. So just wanted the board to be aware of that.
Am I hearing correctly, Bill, that you're not coming, that you have not requested to come back, that you do not want to come back?
That is correct. I find that the time involvement that I've had to put in is very excessive, and I've been very frustrated by the lack of cooperation and communication with the city on almost anything. That it's just not worth it from my standpoint to do another 3 years like that. So I have not asked. I have not asked, nor was I asked. I mean, it may be mutual. I wasn't asked to continue, and I haven't asked to be reappointed. So I would expect I would probably be going off the board shortly, whether that's this month, next month, but definitely this year. I wouldn't be on the board going forward. That's where we stand, but again, lack of communication from the city has us up in the air in limbo a little bit on this issue. So that's where we're
disappointed. I'm very disappointed. I'm sad to hear that, Bill. You've done a great job, and I'd like to say that, you know, I so appreciate all the work you've done, but I also am very troubled by what you're saying.
Well, thank you very much, Tina. Is there, I guess with that, we can open up for any public discussion. If there, are there still people out listening in, John?
Well, before you do that, I just want to also, you know, just on behalf of myself and the staff, thank all of, you know, Joe, Bill, Susan, and Nick, and hopefully Nick will see you next month, which I think based on my conversations with Tristan, we will. And, you know, Susan, I really appreciate you stepping in when you did and being part of the Investment Advisory Committee. You've added a lot to the board. And
thank you.
And Bill, you've done, a great job stepping in and helping us getting the whole bill implemented. Implemented and everything like that. So thank you.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
If you can, John, open up to see if anybody wants to make a comment before we go into closed session.
Yeah, if you'll press 5-star on your phone, I'll unmute your line. I'm not seeing anybody.
Okay, very good. Well, why don't we go?
Hold a second. We do have one.
What?
We do have one.
Yeah, John and Kelly, this is Ken Sprecher. I'd just like to thank Bill for your service in the past 3 years during this transition period. I know it's been a difficult time, and I think you've done an admirable job, and I really appreciate the time and effort that you have put into it.
Thank you.
And I just would like to make one comment regarding the last portion of the agenda. As I've not followed the meetings every month online or in person, but the private market assets, from what I'm looking at, comprise over 40% of the portfolio, and I'm just surprised that the board was not more curious about that aspect of the portfolio. It obviously is not performing very well, and I know this is old news, but it just seems to me like this is a problem that I hope everybody is aware of and is on top of. And that's really the only comment that I have, and I appreciate all the work the staff has done, and continued success to all of you.
I just would add to that, thank you for the comments, but these troubled investments, which are large and troubled, are something that we spend a lot of time on, in a month out, Lone Star, there have been several subcommittee meetings. There have been several negotiations. HUP is discussed constantly. So I think the reason you didn't hear anything during the presentation is that the board is pretty much up to date on all of these. And again, we're going into closed session to discuss Lone Star again because of some of the legal issues that are involved, and we've taken certain actions. So I think everybody realizes that. And then if you look at Kent's slide, his priorities, his number one priority is the liquidation of these troubled illiquid assets. So I appreciate it, but I assure you that this is top of mind to everybody on the board and is getting the bulk of our attention. So thank you.
And as a board member, I can tell you, we've already gone through our seven stages of grief. So, you know, these things have been going on for quite some time, but thanks for the comment.
Okay, with that, let's go into closed session to cover Lone Star and the legal issues.